Welcome to Mastering Logical Fallacies, the online course. This is the audio version of the online course presented at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. For the complete learning experience, including multimedia presentations, quizzes, assignments, peer-to-peer discussion, instructor interaction, and more, enroll as a student at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. My name is Beau Bennett, and I am your instructor for this course. The appeal to faith fallacy can simply be defined as an abandonment of reason. In argumentation, if somebody pulls out the faith card, especially early on in the conversation, essentially what they're doing is they're pulling out a argument stopper. Once somebody appeals to faith and says, well, you just have to have faith, then they're not looking for reason. They're not looking to rationally explain something, to rationally understand something. They are basically saying, this is where I draw the line, and I believe it because I believe it. This is a problem, of course, in argumentation, if you are looking to get to the truth, and if you're looking to get to the truth through rational discourse. If one party stops that process by appealing to faith, then there's really nothing more you can do. Now, in this context, I'm defining faith as believing in something disproportionate to the evidence. Now, people can appeal to faith in a religious context or even a secular context. Generally, this fallacy occurs in a religious context, but I do want to mention that it can occur in a secular context. It's just a different form of the fallacy. If somebody says, I just know, or because I just feel it, or just because, or something along that line, it's very similar to the appeal to faith fallacy, because there is no explanation. There's nothing else that you could talk about in order to get down to the actual reasons and to explore something critically. You're just putting a stop right in the conversation right there and then. And again, you could appeal to faith, you could appeal to just because, you could appeal to I just know. There are many different ways you could do it. Now, generally in our culture, in the United States, faith is considered a virtue. It's considered a good thing. And there are many reasons for this. One has to do with historical reasons, but what I want to talk about is the idea that most people share the same object of faith within this culture. And when that happens, it's easy for everybody to jump on the bandwagon and say that faith is a good thing, until somebody from another culture will declare their faith in something in which we do not agree. For example, if somebody said, well, I want to fly my airplane into this building because I'm going to be with 72 virgins after the deed is done, and you say, whoa, wait a minute, why do you think that? And they say, because I have faith in it. Then the problem of faith becomes more apparent. One more important point to understand with the appeal to faith fallacy, it's often used as a manipulation tactic. Historically, if you look back and study the sociology of different cults, you will see that the cult leaders almost always use this appeal to faith because they don't have any evidence or any support for the claims that they're making, and there's just no logical way to justify some of the things that they say and actually following them and doing the things they do. So very often, these cult leaders will try to get their followers to really appeal to the faith and just have faith in them and have faith in the version of the higher power that they are espousing. The point of this lesson is not to make a judgment on believing in things without enough evidence or having faith or saying just because or saying that I just feel it and making any kind of judgment whether that's right or wrong in different situations. The point of this lesson is just to point out the fallaciousness of using that line in argumentation and the fallaciousness of appealing to faith in place of offering rational arguments or reasons to why you believe something. The entire concept of faith can excuse somebody from examining their own thoughts and beliefs rationally and critically, and that's a problem as well. The appeal to heaven is a fallacy similar to the appeal to faith, in that the conclusion must be accepted because it's the will of God, or the will of the gods, or because it's in the Bible, or something along those lines. Now, generally in argumentation, what we do is we unpack reasons. So, for example, if I were to say that the government wants us to do X, therefore we should do X, we could look at that statement and somebody could argue with me and say, okay, well, let's unpack that. What do you mean the government wants you to do X? How do you know the government wants you to do X? Let's look in the information. Let's find out where the government said this or said something similar to it. And let's look at the moral implications of it. And let's just keep on exploring this. And then we could come to the conclusion, or we at least could come make a better decision if the government wants us to do X or not after looking at all these factors and critically examining it. The reason the appeal to heaven is a fallacy is because there's none of that if we were to say that God wants us to do X. And it should be clear that this, you could see how this is not always a fallacy. There can be some very liberal Christians, maybe very liberal religious people in general, who might appeal to a God, a deity, or some kind of holy text authority, and will be open to critically examining that conclusion. So if I were to say, well, because God wants us to mow the lawn on Sundays and not Saturdays, and somebody said, well, wait, how do you know that? And if I said, well, in the book, in the Bible, I remember reading something about not working on Saturdays, and then say, well, yeah, you know, but that was for the Jewish people, and that was 3,000 years ago, and that was written by unknown authors. And so, and then we could explore that line of argumentation, and after considering all these new facts and reasons, I could come to either a different conclusion or I could stick with the conclusion based on other reasons that I might come up in the argumentation process. And that would be okay. However, that's not what usually happens when somebody appeals to a divine authority. What generally happens is they will say that God wanted me to do this. And they feel that they have some kind of inside information, like God was talking to them, and whether it really is a God talking to them, or if it's their intuitive tendencies, if it's their subconscious, if it's what they had for dinner the other night, it could be a host of things, but there's no way to know that. But if they were to insist that they have information, to insist that they know something, and there's nothing that you could say to change their mind, then the conversation's over, we have left rational argumentation, and now we're just going back to faith. So in a way, the appeal to heaven is sort of a more specific version of the appeal to faith. It's sort of layered on top of it. Now, there's an ongoing debate as to whether religion and science are compatible. And some people say it is, some people say it isn't. Personally, I say, well, it is in some aspects and it isn't in other aspects. It's not a black and white issue. It's not all or nothing. There are different aspects of the science that are certainly compatible with religion and certain aspects and beliefs of religion that are not compatible with science. Likewise, I like to do my best and respect people's faith and say that critical thinking is compatible with faith, but I really can't say that as an absolute. I could say that in some ways it is and in some ways it isn't. And this is one of those ways that it isn't compatible with critical thinking. So if you are one of the people who do consider faith a virtue, then the best I could do is give you a warning. If somebody tells you that they have a direct communication with the being that you believe in as well, the deity that you believe in as well, and they give you a message, the best I could tell you is just to be skeptical, and you might want to ask a few more questions. Magical thinking is sometimes known as a fallacy, sometimes it's known as a cognitive bias, and sometimes it's just known as a way of thinking, a major part of our cognition. Magical thinking is essentially when we make causal connections or correlations between two different events, not based on any kind of logic or reason or evidence, but based mostly on superstition or something that has no basis in reality. And what I find amusing many times is so many people who are, you know, consider themselves reasonable people, rationalists, many people who will reject any kind of superstitious belief. And they reject magical thinking, and they might laugh at it and say that it's ridiculous when people engage in magical thinking, yet they don't realize that we all engage in some level of magical thinking. It's just the way the mind works. What's different, though, if you are a critical thinker and you are a rationalist and you think about your own magical thinking and you think about the connections that you make, you would be able to point it out and say, you know what, this is not based on reason. This is unreasonable, and I understand this, but yet I still can't help feeling this way. I still can't help thinking this way, and that is magical thinking in a nutshell. But it's fallacious, and it becomes a fallacy when you're engaged in reason and somebody does not make that connection, that it's not reasonable, and it's just part of how they process information. There are many examples. Let's say a rabbit's foot. Somebody will not go on an airplane without bringing their rabbit's foot because they think that they'll crash, or they're more likely to crash if they don't have the rabbit's foot. That is magical thinking. And they may even say, and I've met some people like this who would even say, I know it's ridiculous, but it just makes me feel better. That's a perfect example of magical thinking, how deeply ingrained it is in our biology, in our psyche. And we live with it all the time. And there are other more mild forms of magical thinking. There's, for example, if we think about our own death, right? And we think about what is going to happen to us after we die, or let's not say that. Yeah, okay, let's talk about what's going to happen to our bodies after we die. And I think most of us, no matter what our belief system is we don't just want to be thrown out on the street and let the buzzards eat our bodies. We would rather have something a little bit more dignified. Maybe we would like the idea of having a ceremony. Maybe we'd like the idea of being buried or being cremated or something along those lines. We want something to happen to our body. But if you think about this, why? You know, why does it matter? I mean, we're dead. We don't have any. If you are, let me go back a step and say, if you are, if you don't believe in any kind of afterlife, and you believe that once we die, we're dead, then it makes no sense to be concerned about what's going to happen to your physical body after you're dead. And it really makes no sense to be concerned about anything. What's going to happen to your family, how they're going to get along without you, the earth, the people that are going to be here after you. I mean, that really makes no sense. But yet, it still concerns us. We're still concerned with what happens to the people we love after we die, even though there's no us, or we believe that there's no us afterwards. And this is a type of magical thinking and a type of, I don't know if I'd go as far as calling it superstition, but it's something that is deeply ingrained and it's very hard to get rid of because we cannot imagine what happens to us. We cannot imagine not existing. It's just something that essentially we can't do. We cannot imagine not existing. So when we imagine us not being around, we still imagine some kind of existence. And that's a form of magical thinking that pretty much we all have. Another experiment was done with some researchers that said that a sweater belonged to a serial killer, and they wanted to know who would wear it for a day. And they even went to people who do not believe in any kind of supernatural or any kind of essence or any kind of platonic structures or anything along those lines. And still an alarmingly large number of people would not wear this psychopath's sweater or a sweater that was allegedly belonged to a psychopath. Because there's still this idea that there's some kind of essence on that sweater that would transfer over to us. And it's one of those beliefs, that the magical thinking that we have, that is just very hard to shake. So magical thinking comes in many different forms. There is, like I mentioned before, with the whole lucky rabbit's foot and bringing that on a plane, that's a very common and a more dangerous form of magical thinking in terms of reason and rationality, especially when we bring that kind of belief system into the political spectrum, into things that really have a real effect on humanity. And we start thinking that there is some kind of magical causal connection between either praying for rain or doing some kind of dance, carrying some kind of lucky charm, and or holding a certain or a certain practice, for example, like the reason that the hurricane happened or the earthquake happened in Haiti a few years back was because of homosexuals. That was a claim, and that's a great example of how magical thinking can be extremely destructive and offensive to so many people. So there are certainly dangerous forms of magical thinking, fallacious forms of magical thinking. But we also have to realize that there are many benign forms of magical thinking that virtually every one of us holds to some degree. And it's incredibly hard to shake. But many people would argue that it's a good thing that we have this magical thinking. Maybe it serves some kind of evolutionary purpose that allows us to create a better world and allows humanity to continue and allows our offspring to continue in a better environment and so forth. So there's magical thinking for you in a nutshell. I spent many years debating in the area of religion, and one fallacy that kept on popping up its head over and over and over again was what I call the spiritual fallacy. Now, this is where somebody can use this as kind of like a get-out-of-jail-free card and call upon this spiritual definition in place of an actual definition. Or if they're backed into a corner where something really didn't happen, something wasn't meant to be taken literally, or something just is not true, then they could say that it's a spiritual truth. So if you just put the word spiritual in front of the claim, it all of a sudden somehow makes it okay. Well, there are some times when this will be okay and sometimes when it is a fallacy. When it is okay is when, specifically when religious documents use the terminology spiritual in front of the claim that they're making. If you are Christian and you read the Bible, there are plenty of times when the word spiritual is used in the Bible. And I believe in my book I quoted something from 1 Corinthians when they talk about a spiritual drink that they've drank. And that makes it clear that the author is speaking about something spiritual, whatever that means and whatever you want it to mean. I don't want to get into a debate what spiritual actually means, and I don't want to support the fact that it actually does mean something or that it doesn't mean something. That's irrelevant to this fallacy. The fallacy occurs when somebody makes a claim, like let's say that they read from a holy document, and they say, and they insist on the truth of the document, and it says something completely contrary to the truth, that's demonstrably false, but they go ahead and say, well, it's a spiritual truth, and you have to understand it spiritually. Now, if you think about why this is a fallacy, and I'm not making any claims whether that is true or it's not. That's irrelevant. The reason why it's a fallacy is because we're leaving the realm of reason. We're no longer talking about something that says something, it means something completely different. Once we are allowed to say that, then again, we completely left the realm of reason and we can have a reasonable conversation. Take, for example, if we were to do this with the Constitution and it said something like, all men are created equal. And then we say, well, they don't really mean that. What they mean is that it's a spiritual truth. We're spiritually created equal. So therefore, we can treat some people horribly and treat others fine. And of course, that would be ridiculous. It'd be ridiculous because it says right there what it means, and there's no mention of spiritual anywhere as that little qualifier to get you out of that situation. But so many people put that in because they don't want to admit that, oh yeah, you know what, the people who wrote this might have been incorrect at the time. And it's hard for many people of faith to come to that conclusion that, oh yeah, you know, this may not be 100% right. And then, of course, if you go down that path thinking that something's even just a little bit wrong, then that could, well, wait, how could it be wrong if it's the Word of God? And then you start asking a lot of questions, and it takes you to a very dark place that many people do not want to go. So a lot of times it's easier to say, you know what, well, that's truth. It's true, but it's a spiritual truth. And that's where we're committing the fallacy. And that's what's called the spiritual fallacy.